Welcome to Good Evening, the Alfred Hitchcock Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me, as always, on the line, is my ever-constant co-hosts, Tom Caldwell and Chris Haig. Chris, how are you doing today? What's that, you got some weird mark around your neck here. Is that a scarf? Who's behind you?
Tell me, I don't understand. What?
No. I was really self-conscious when you started talking. I was there going like, what? What is it? What is it? And I just didn't realize until you were like, oh, is that a scarf? And I'm like, oh, get it. Get it. Yeah, I'm okay. I have managed to survive yet another murder attempt. And there's the body of, you know, one of my husband's former classmates on the floor. But apart from that, I'm pretty good.
Excellent. Tom, how you doing? You going to come to the stag party with me?
Yeah, I'm ready to go. Just give me a moment. I'm trying to find my house key here. It's in one of my duffel coats. I'll be right with you there.
Okay, let me ask you this question here before we go too far. What the heck is a stag party? Because, you know, all that I remember when I was a kid is there was like a Bugs Bunny cartoon. And he's like, hey, let's watch this video. And he throws on this projector and it starts up and says stag reel. And then he's like, no, that's the wrong one. And he like completely freaks out. Hey, so like ever since I'm a kid, I've assumed that stag meant like porno or something like this. What's a stag party?
Well, a stag party, I think in the modern definition is like you're going to get married. So the boys all go out ahead of time with the groom and,
You
know, right?
Go to the strip club and get drunk and do bad things that he can't do once he's married. Right.
Yeah. It's a bachelor party.
Right. So, but what is that what this is?
The stag party in this film, I think they're literally just using a very clean, boring definition of it's a party for men only.
Mm.
And they end up at a banquet room in a fancy hotel wearing tuxedos, sitting around talking about business and smoking. Mm. Like, it's just pretty boring. But it's a stag party in the sense that it's just the men. Mm. And it's like the business. It's kind of like a business club elite kind of. Private club is what they're doing here in the film.
It's like a fancy boys' night out kind of thing, is what they're doing as. But the typical stag, it's a stag party or a stag do is, it's a bachelor party before you go get married.
Okay, I guess that when I got married, we had a stag party too. I think we called it a stag party. I don't think we called it a bachelor party. We could have called it a bachelor party. I don't know. I don't remember.
Don't remember it, it was a good time.
Excellent. Yes. Awesome. Okay. Well, thank you for elaborating on that because, I'm like, man, that whatever this sounds like really weird. So, and then they go to the party and I'm like, man, whatever this is really boring. So,
yes.
My version of fun times would be having people over. And Tom, I am just devastated that I couldn't have you over. So we're still under the COVID lockdown. We had some ridiculous lockdown restrictions lifted this week that we can't even apply. So I wanted Tom to come over because I've got a 3D TV and I actually have this movie on 3D Blu-ray and I wanted to be able to share it with him and have him discuss it as well.
But Brandon's been talking about this for like 6 months, but I'm glad that you were
so excited.
I'm glad you were able to, watch that. I want to talk about the 3D thing a bit later on for sure.
Yeah. Well, I've bought this on 3D quite a while ago, because I love 3D, right? I think 3D is fun. And I've got a 3D projector, and I recently bought a used 3D TV as well. I guess almost a year ago now, it was pretty close to when the pandemic started that I actually bought one. But it's like, I love 3D, and this is one of the first 3D movies that I bought, and so I've watched this in 3D like 3 or 4 times now, right? Because I've had the 3D projector for almost 10 years. We bought that like right when I moved into this house, so I don't use the projector too often, but that's why I wanted to get the TV, was so I could use my 3D more. So,
but
anyways, well, we'll
come back to that later.
Awesome, yeah, we'll talk about that. So, first, let's jump into the summary.
I'll have a quick summary for you here. The story is basically a former tennis player tries to arrange his wife's murder after learning of her affair.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think the first version of this movie I saw was the one with Michael Douglas and Gwyneth Paltrow. It was called The Perfect Murder.
Right.
Have you guys seen that one?
I haven't.
Remake of it?
No.
Nope.
Yeah, that was the first I was exposed to this story. So, but yeah, this movie's really good. Awesome. So let us jump into a little bit of the history of the making of Dial M for Murder. So Dial M for Murder is a 1954 American crime mystery thriller film directed by Alfred Hitchcock, starring Ray Milland, Grace Kelly, Robert Cummings, Anthony Dawson, and John Williams, not the composer. Both the screenplay and the successful stage play on which it was based were written by English playwright Frederick Knott. The play premiered in 1952 on BBC television before being performed on stage in the same year in London's West End. The film earned an estimated $2.7 million in North America and box office sales in 1954. Now, the release date, Wikipedia shows two release dates. So there was May 18th, 1954 in Philadelphia. So that must have been like the world premiere or something like that. And then it had its general release on May 29th of 1954 as a running time of 105 minutes. After I Confess, Hitchcock planned to film The Bramble Bush, based on the 1948 novel by David Duncan, as a Transatlantic Pictures production with partner Sidney Bernstein. However, there were problems with the script and budget, and Hitchcock and Bernstein decided to dissolve their partnership. Warner Brothers allowed Hitchcock to scrap the film and begin production on Dial M for Murder. Mark's name was changed for the film. In the original play, he was Max Halliday. Actors Dawson and Williams reprised their roles from Broadway as Swan and Captain Lesgett and the Inspector Hubbard, respectively. Dial M for Murder was shot using Warner Brothers' own proprietary 3D camera rig, the so-called all-media camera. After one preview performance on May 18th and four showings on the 19th, the Philadelphia theater manager frantically contacted the studio and said that people were staying away in droves. He asked permission to drop the 3D and show the film flat. On May 23rd, the Philadelphia Inquirer reported that the first audiences proved to be a jury that could not only make up its mind, but could make it up in a hurry. In exhibitors' own terms, Dial M literally died, and after just four performances on Wednesday, some long-distance telephoning to report complaints, the increasing skimpiness of customers, a good many of them making no bones of their dissatisfaction, permission was given to throw away the glasses and hastily switch to the 2D version, whereupon business at the Randolph took a turn for the better. Dial M for Murder marked the end of the brief flirtation with 3D films of the early 50s. Hitchcock said of 3D, "It's a 9-day wonder, and I came in on the 9th day." Now, I guess I'll talk about it here. So I watched this on 3D, and I gotta say, the 3D in this movie is pretty terrible. This is one of the worst 3D movies I've ever seen. And I think watching it, part of the problem is actually Hitchcock's filmmaking technique that he uses. I think the problem in this instance is actually Hitchcock, because he uses a lot of, he would do on set with the rear projection of like backgrounds and stuff. And those scenes do not look good in 3D. And actually, multiple times when I watch this movie, it actually does start to hurt my eyes and it starts to give me a headache when I watch this movie in 3D. I still watch it in 3D because I love 3D and I suffer through it. But yeah, this movie is not a very good 3D quality film. The graininess of the rear projection is really contradictory with the people that are walking in front of it. And the color system that's being used, like some of the rear, the farther images are really blurry. They don't look very well at all. When it's just in the room, it actually looks pretty good. And, you know, like the overhead shot when they're going through the scene of like describing the murder looks really good. There's a lot of scenes where there's like lamps in front of the camera and stuff that look really good. The scene where Grace Kelly's arm reaches out is actually pretty cool in 3D, right? When she goes to, her hand does come quite out of the TV quite a bit. And then she grabs the scissors. And then when John Williams is the cop, he like brings the key right into the camera frame is a pretty effective shot as well. So there's a couple of really fun shots in here. And Hitchcock does do a very good job of trying to create depth. But the scenes when he relies on his old school cheaper filmmaking techniques is really what drags the 3D down.
To me, this film is, it's a very straightforward parlor story. It's a play that happens pretty much in one room, and it's it's a story of characters interacting. But if you're going to do a 3D film, you do an action film. You have guns and flying things and helicopters or whatever, and, you know, trains, and you have exciting things happen on the screen in the big world that it take advantage of the 3D nature of the photography. But this, it's almost like, why would they bother doing this film in 3D? Like, it's a boring, it's not a boring film. It's an excellent story, but it just doesn't strike me as that type of a film that deserves to have a 3D treatment. Yeah. And realistically, 3D is a bit of a gimmick, and I don't think Hitchcock didn't need gimmicks for people to enjoy his films. His films were amazing as they were. They didn't need to have like tinsel wrapped around the edges to make them more appealing, right?
Yeah.
Right, right, right.
No, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like in modern times there was kind of a 2000-2010 resurgence really of 3D, and you know, there were some fantastic examples of it. So the ones that I remember, like Avatar or Gravity or Mad Max, and all those ones where it's like action and it's, you know, stuff being thrown at you and you kind of understand it. But then no one's saying, oh, tell you what deserved a 3D thing, Brief Encounter, Rope, you know, Citizen Kane. I think 3D is basically, it was misapplied. It was a real, a bad mashup between film and technique. I've never seen the 3D version, so I can't comment on how, if it looks shoddy, if it looks shoddy or anything like that, but I can't imagine, apart from the examples you gave, of anything in the film where I'd have been like, oh, I bet that's cool in 3D.
Right, right. Yeah, there's not a lot. Like, 3D itself, depending on the technology, like, it wasn't very well made. Like, you got to line up two cameras side by side, and they got to be in perfect alignment for things to work. Like, you know, Shout Factory just released the Friday the 13th box set, and they included a new scan of Friday the 13th Part 3 in 3D. And even that film, like, it doesn't look really good in 3D. There's a lot of really fun, cheesy 3D effects in it, which makes it really entertaining. But just, again, with the coloring is off, and it's very soft focus. It doesn't look very good. And then the newer 3D technology does look a whole heck of a lot better. So I still enjoy 3D, and I think it's fun. And I will probably never watch Dial M for Murder in 2D, but Warner Brothers told Hitchcock to do this in 3D. He didn't have a choice. It was like part of the contract, right? So Hitchcock didn't conceive of this film in 3D, you know, so it wasn't his choice to make it this way. And I think that had Hitchcock been given the opportunity to say, hey, like, had Warner Brothers gone to him and said, hey, Hitchcock, we want you to make a film in 3D, and we want you to come up with what you want to do for it, I really think Hitchcock could have come up with something very special. Yeah. But again, with this being right at the end of the 3D craze of the 50s, he just didn't have the opportunity for it. So I'm glad that we have it, because it's a fun oddity in his career. But it's not necessary for the film at all.
I've just realized, do you know what I think would have done great in 3D? North by Northwest.
Right, exactly.
Okay, yeah.
You've got the planes, you've got people falling, you've got guns, you know, the train and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I think that would have actually suited it a lot better. But, yeah, I mean, I suppose the beauty of this is that in 3D, it doesn't ruin the excellent 2D version of it. There's not so many elements it becomes sort of distracting in 2D.
Yeah.
There's not loads of, like, reaching a hand into camera for no reason. Like, those sort of moments. So, I mean, at least there's that version as well.
Yeah. Oh, excellent. In February of 1980, the dual strip system was used for a revival of the film in 3D at the New York Theater in San Francisco. This revival did so well that Warner Brothers did a limited national re-release of the film in February of 1982 using Chris Condon's single strip stereo vision 3D system, including a sold-out engagement at the Detroit Institute of Arts. The film was shown in 3D in some UK cinemas during the summer of 2013 and in Italy at the beginning of fall of the same year, and then Warner Brothers released the Dial M for Murder on 3D Blu-ray on October 9th of 2012. Okay, let's jump into the actors of the film. Ray Milland was a Welsh-American actor and film director. His screen career ran from 1929 to 1985, and he is best remembered for his Academy Award-winning portrayal of an alcoholic writer in Billy Wilder's The Lost Weekend from 1945, and also for such roles as a sophisticated leading man opposite John Wayne's corrupt character in Reap the Wild Wind, and Oliver Barrett III in Love Story from 1970. This is his only Hitchcock film appearance, but he was also in the Alfred Hitchcock Hour episode A Home Away from Home. Grace Patricia Kelly was an American film actress who, after starring in several significant films in the early to mid-50s, became Princess of Monaco by marrying Prince Rainer III in April of 1956. After graduating from the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in 1949, she began appearing in New York City theatrical productions and over 40 live drama productions broadcast in the early 50s golden age of television. Kelly gained stardom from her performance in John Ford's adventure romance, Mogambo, from 1953, starring Clark Gable and Ava Gardner, which won her a Golden Globe and Academy Award nominations. She won the Academy Award for Best Actress for her performance in the drama The Country Girl from 1954 with Bing Crosby, and other notable works include the western High Noon with Gary Cooper, the romance comedy High Society with Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra, and three consecutive Alfred Hitchcock suspense thrillers. Kelly retired from acting at age 26 to marry Rainer, and she began her duties as Princess of Monaco. Hitchcock hoped that she would appear in more of his films, which required an icy blonde lead actress, but he was unable to coax her out of retirement. The prince and princess had three children. Princess Grace retained her link to America by her foundation to support local artisans in 1964, and her Organization for Children's Rights, AMADE Mondiale, gained consecutive status with UNICEF and UNESCO. She died aged 52 at Monaco Hospital on September 14, 1982, from injuries sustained in a car crash the previous day. She's listed 13th among the American Film Institute's 25 greatest female stars of classic Hollywood cinema. Her son, Prince Albert, helped establish the Princess Grace Awards in 1984 to recognize emerging performers in film, theater, and dance. And the two films that we'll see her in coming up is Rear Window and To Catch a Thief. Now, we spoke about Robert Cummings when we covered Saboteur, and this is his final Hitchcock appearance. And finally, we'll talk about John Williams, who was a Tony Award-winning English stage, film, and television actor. He remembers for his role as Chief Inspector Hubbard in Dial M for Murder, and as the chauffeur in Billy Wilder's Sabrina, and as the second Mr. French on TV's Family Affair in its first season. We saw him in an uncredited role in the Paradine case. He played Barrister Collins, and we will see him one more time in To Catch a Thief. But if you watch Alfred Hitchcock Presents, he's in many episodes, some that we've talked about and some that we will talk about. But he was in The Long Shot, Back for Christmas, Whodunit, Wet Saturday, The Rose Garden, I Killed the Count, Parts 1, 2, and 3, The Three Dreams of Mr. Findlater, and Banco's Chair. Now, Alfred Hitchcock's cameo is a very interesting one. It can be seen 13 minutes into the film in a black and white reunion photograph sitting at the banquet table among former students and faculty. And that's what we've got for trivia on the film. So, any of you guys, was this your first time watching this film?
No.
No. Actually, this film to me is a real special place in my Hitchcock heart, because you guys, you know, I've talked before on the show about how Jeanette and I in our house for about 5 years in a row would have Hitchcock parties. So we'd have a Saturday afternoon, Saturday day and evening party, and we'd have various people come over and we'd show three or four films in our house throughout the day. And the first time we did this, we were both driving home from work together, my wife and I, like on the Friday, and she's like, you go ahead and use the house and have your friends over. I'll just stay out of the way and you guys can have fun watching your movies. And that weekend, we watched the films on the Saturday. Then Jeanette and I watched Dial M for Murder on the Sunday together, and she's like, these are great films. And she got right into it. And I'm like, see, I told you. And so I've always enjoyed this film because it was a connection for the two of us to enjoy the films together. And Jeanette's a big fan of TV cop shows and the evening dramas and the fire department, you know, Chicago, this and all that. Like the sort of police dramas. So she, I think, really identified with this movie. So to me, that's important, that this is an accessible film that people that aren't necessarily Hitchcock fans can enjoy. But really, it's a classic police drama. It's a wonderful film. It's so well done. And again, having seen it a few times in the past, I watched it a couple days ago preparing for a show, and I ate it up. Like, I really enjoyed following the story as it went.
Mm-hmm. Chris, what are your thoughts on this film?
I mean, so I adore this film. I love it. When I was first getting into Hitchcock, it was one of the first ones I watched, and I watched it on TV, and I only caught the second half from the murder onwards, because we'll go into proper spoilers later on. But I caught the second half and was immediately entranced, and I was like, oh my god, I have to get this. So I got a really cheap copy of it on DVD and watched it, and it's one of those where it's so tense and yet calm. There's no shouting, there's no kind of chasing, that sort of thing. It is very much a stage play that happens to be filmed. And I just love how, you know, I can put this on whenever and really enjoy it. It is such a masterclass in tension and expectation and subversion, because at first it's a thriller and then it's partially a little bit of like a murder mystery, but then at the halfway point it really switches into something else. And then for the last third, it becomes this sort of race to the finish line where, you know, the person who you thought was the main character is, you know, turns out to be the, you know, the real villain of the piece. And then, you know, you have this unexpected hero emerging, which I really enjoyed because I love the cast. I love Ray Milland. I love Grace Kelly. I love, you know, John Williams is a bit of a revelation for me. And I, you know, that feeling you get when you're like, oh my God. And, at, you know, two separate roles, you never realized they were played by the same actor. I didn't, until I started doing these, I never twigged that he was Audrey Hepburn's dad in Sabrina. Until I literally watched it for this and I went, oh my God. And I never twigged, because it's such a different role. You know, and we've seen him in, you know, Back Home for Christmas, where he plays a real villain. And we've seen him in Wet Saturday, where he plays a where he plays like a victim, and in this he gets to really play such a cool, smart sort of Inspector Alan Poirot detective hero, and it's really satisfying. But yeah, I have one issue with this, and it's not actually even a complaint. It's something that, to this day, and it's just the way my brain works, I can never work out the, you know, the last bit where he's going through the process and it's all the key stuff. I can never work it out. To this day, I could have someone draw me a map and it's like, right, the key goes there, and then this person picks up the wrong key, and then that goes back in the thing. For some reason, my brain just doesn't do it. I love it, but my brain just won't compute.
Yeah. Well, I could tell you about it if you want. I can explain
it. Yeah, bring it on.
So he's talking with the husband, right? Which, I'm bad with characters, so I'm going to do a lot of the husband and whatnot. So he's talking with the husband, he's there, and he wants to take a look at his banking book. And so after the husband goes out, he takes the key, because Grace Kelly's in jail, he takes the key out of her purse and tries to sneak in when the husband's not there, and he can't get in. And so he's confused, and that's when he finally realizes the fact that the dead body of Lesgit there, Swan, didn't have a key on him at all, right? And so he started to puzzle it all together and put it together. And so what he did was he knew that either the wife let him in or somebody left the key for him to get in. And after looking around for half an hour, he found the key under the stairs and realized that it worked. And so his solution was to test them. And so they both were tested with the same wrong key in the purse. And whichever them one of them realized that the key was under the steps would have been the person that broke that, that was responsible for Lesgit getting into the house.
Yeah.
Right, is how he determined it out. Because he did take that wrong key and tried it on Lesgit's own apartment, and it worked on Lesgit's apartment, right? So they took the key, they clearly then took the key out of Lesgit's pocket and put it in Grace Kelly's purse. So whoever did that, you know, was also part of the crime. So
here's the thing. You've explained that really well. I promise you, in like 20 minutes, I won't remember it. I really won't, because it's one of those things that's like sleight of hand almost. So it will eventually. Yeah, yeah. If I watch it enough times, and it's a great incentive to watch it again and again, it will eventually sink into my brain. But it's a bit like a sort of when someone explains at the end of an Agatha Christie going like, ha-ha, you thought it was a gunshot, but actually, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I'm like, okay, fine. But anyway, go on.
You know what bugged me about the key?
What?
Does nobody have a key ring? Like, who carries a key? Like, just floating around like that? That's what bothered me, but I got over it. Like, I don't have keys. I don't carry keys that aren't on a key ring.
I'm not going to... This is going to sound so stupid. When were key rings invented?
I'm not sure.
A long time ago.
I just was like, was it a time before? Because my...
But if they don't have a car...
Yeah, because
you know, if they don't have a car, they don't need lots of keys. They don't need another key for the car.
Yeah. But I would... Yeah, that's just me. I would never carry a...
Yeah, one key by itself. But the car he was trying to sell was actually not his own, right? It was the woman he was dating, and he was trying to profit off of her selling the car, right? So that wasn't even his car.
Right.
Right? So, you know, he doesn't own a car. So, yeah. Things like that. So he wouldn't have that many keys probably. So, and, yeah. I love this movie. I think this movie's fantastic. There's only one thing that really doesn't work for me, but it also doesn't really take away from my enjoyment of the film. And I think that the actor, I think Robert Cummings is miscast in this one. I don't really buy him as the boyfriend, like the author. So he doesn't quite work for me in this one. Like, and that could just be because Ray Milland is so well cast in this role. Like, he is so charming as a character, even though he's so evil. Yeah. He's wanting to kill his wife. He is perfectly cast in this role. That the contrast with Ray Milland, or the contrast with Robert Cummings, is a really drastic contrast to me. What do you guys think about the casting of Robert Cummings in this?
Were the two men, the two characters, were maybe a little too similar to each other? I kind of got a little bit of that, where they were a little bit hard to tell apart. But anyway, sorry, Chris, go ahead.
No, I was just thinking, yeah, the one thing I'll say about the boyfriend is, and I feel really mean for saying this, but he's quite bland. Like, if you said, what's his personality, I'd be like, he's a writer. But that's not his personality, that's his job. That's it. That is literally all we ever know about him. I mean, it's interesting because Ray Milland is so well cast. And then out of the three appearances that Grace Kelly makes, this for me is right in the middle. She's, you know, for me, she's great. And I think it's interesting that she swings from, and we're talking still in like a Hays Code era where, oh, well, she's a cheating wife. She should get punished or, you know, be forced to find redemption or end up back with her husband. Whereas in this, she's very likable and sympathetic right off the bat, even though she is having an affair. And it's the instigating incident really for her husband. Although, to be fair, I always get the sense from Tony that he's just been kind of waiting for an excuse really to bump her off and get her money. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, casting wise, I think it's great. I think it's so funny though, in that the entire film gets, you know, it really belongs to Ray Milland. That's great, but only for like the first 2/3, because then immediately it becomes the John Williams show.
Ray,
and Ray Milland. Yeah, sorry.
Ray playing Tony, He's a very strong, smart, intelligent, capable manipulator. Like, he's got it all planned out. When things start to go wrong, he still uses his charm to kind of pull things back into what he needs to have happen. And he does well throughout the film of keeping his cool, even when Mark Halliday, the boyfriend, confronts him in front of the inspector with the bag full of money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he manages to just water off his back. That just sort of, you know, that's, oh, I've got a reason for that. Like, I can explain that, you know?
Yeah.
A whole bunch of very cool characters. And I really do appreciate how all the conflict is very intelligent conversation, and there's no yelling and screaming and pushing and hysterics. Like, it's all very calm and cool. It's a battle of wits, right? And it's a very impressive story to watch. And it's basically who's the smarter manipulator, who's the smarter detective in the long run.
Yeah. And in that scene as well, like, part of it is he deflects it so well. Like, he's like, oh, hey, the boyfriend's like, hey, detective, look at this money. And then Tony comes in there and he's like, yeah, there's money. But you know what? This guy just told me to confess to the murder. Right. And he told me to come up with this whole crazy story about the murder and how I actually did it. What do you think of that? Like, he just deflects the question about the money completely. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's what's really great about the writing of this. But, you know, the writing of this play is so amazing. Like, that first act, in my opinion, is the best part of the film. Like, that the act between Lesgut and Tony, where they're talking about the murder, and Tony's talking about, I followed you, and I was watching you do this, and, you know, I finally was able to dig up dirt on you, and the way that they're explaining the murder and laying it out for you is just, it's so captivating. That whole first, what is it, 30 or 40 minutes of the film is just completely captivating, and it's so well done with just those two guys, you know. And I love stage production. You know, I used to be in stage productions when I was in high school and whatnot. I used to be in plays, and there's never any types of plays like this. They're usually musicals that I was in, but I love stage, and I would love to see this performed on stage. I think this would be really great to watch a stage adaptation of this play.
So they, before COVID, in the summer of 2019, my city at Leeds actually hosted, they were doing a UK run of Dial M for Murder as a stage production. And I didn't get to see it, but a friend of mine did and said it was absolutely, it was great. And they even did the stuff like, you know, where it, because it's pretty much all in that one flat, all in that one house, really. But they managed to, you know, there's little shots of when they go to the gentleman's club, or there's like little inserts where it's, you know, Margot's in prison and it's when they've kind of condemned her and all that sort of thing. They managed to do those by flipping the stage around and basically converting it, kind of one in the first half, one in the second half. I think it's so interesting because you're the main character, the person you are following, is the villain. You know, he's this complete narcissist sociopath who, you know, is very adaptable, very quick on his feet, is really good at manipulating people and being charming and outwardly, you know, handsome and intelligent and erudite and all these wonderful things. But he is the villain, you know. And like you said, for the first half hour, you get that amazing scene between between Swan and Tony, where, you know, Tony's manipulation, his first of many manipulations is revealed, and then for the second half, it's like the plan unfolds, and then it goes horribly wrong in Tony's view. But even then, the minute he finds out from Margot, he is so quick at just going like, right, here's how I can flip this, because she has killed someone. All I have to do is cover it up and make it look like, you know, she killed him in a tryst. And then it's, you know, in my head when I was rewatching it before this, all I kept thinking is he is Moriarty, and then in the third act we're seeing Sherlock appear to disrupt his plan and, you know, get, you know, help him get away with it. I mean, for me, the sort of third act with Hubbard and with his sort of careful unpicking of the case, for me, it's actually up there with some of the best Hitchcock, like the films and everything, just that third, because it's so interesting, and the whole battle of wits really does come down to the wire, and it is so, like you said, it's so smart, and I think it's wonderful, and that this is a film where, and in quite a lot of Hitchcock films, it's resolved with an action set piece, or there's a fight, or there's some kind of physical conflict, whereas this, it's entirely down to cunning and intelligence, and, you know, it still manages to be quite warm, so, like, you know, when Hubbard brings Margot, and he says, oh, will you try and get in? She's like, well, it didn't work. And he gives her, it's so weird that this has stuck with me, but he gives her just this really fond little warm look of, you didn't know, did you? And it's almost like his faith has been reaffirmed and his instinct that she didn't do it has been reaffirmed. So, and it's little character moments like that that really make me appreciate this. So it's not just an intellectual exercise in how to get away with murder and then how to not get away with murder. In the, you know, I think it's a real testament to the acting.
Yeah, that act with John Williams, like, he, when he first appears on screen, you're like, you don't really like the character because he's just a cop that's investigating it. And, you know, you're, who you're rooting for changes in this. Like, I don't know about you guys, okay? Maybe I'm a bad person. But when I watch this at the beginning, okay, like, when I'm watching this film during the first act, or I guess really the second act, I almost want the murder to happen. Watching the film, because we've spent so much time with Tony, and he's the main character of the piece, right? And so we're kind of on his side. At least that's how I feel, right? I don't know about you guys, but that's how I feel when I'm watching it. So we want the murder to occur. So when it doesn't go off according to plan, when his watch doesn't work, we're like, oh my goodness, this isn't going to happen. Oh my goodness, Lesgut's going to get caught. What's going on here? And after that, though, when he turns and he puts the blame on Grace Kelly's character, that's when you lose affection. That's when I lose affection for the character, right? And so when the cop comes in at the beginning, when John Williams comes in at the beginning, he's like the antagonist to our protagonist that we've been following.
Yeah.
So I don't really like John Williams at the beginning. But after Grace Kelly gets tried and convicted, we're like, oh man, I feel really bad for this. And then John Williams comes in to be this hero, and our allegiance changes. At least mine does. My allegiance changes in this film, and I change who I'm rooting for. And this is really well done. And I wonder if this is captured this way in a stage production as well. You know, or if this is some way that Hitchcock's been able to bring his directorial style to it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the beauty of film, then, that you can have main characters who aren't protagonists nor virtuous nor heroes. Because it's like, if you look at, and it's weird because when I say this, most people go, I can't believe you like this, but one of my favourite films is The Godfather. Like, the first one. I love it. I can watch it anytime. And I can acknowledge the fact that none of them are good people. With the exception of maybe Kay. But none of them are virtuous, good people. But you still want them to succeed. Because you spend enough time building them up as a character and as a real person and develop this affinity with them, that even though, you know, like just like in The Godfather, the whole of the first act is building to Michael shooting dead a police chief and, you know, another political figure and getting away with it. Even though that's, you know, morally objectionable, you still sat there going, God, I can't wait till he kills him. You know, and even though I think the thing that helps with the whole making Tony the character that you root for, at least in the beginning, is the affair. I think if it had been, oh, he just wants to, if he just wants to bump his wife off for no reason, then that makes him almost more callous and more cold. But because she's been having an affair, it makes it more, there is a justification that I think people can get behind. You know, there's it's got a vague reference to Hitchcock, but there's a film called Les Diaboliques, which is about a guy who...
Such a good movie!
Oh, I know.
I love Clouseau. Clouseau's one of my favourites.
Well, it's... Oh, I've got the book. I'm going to read the book this summer. I'm determined. Because it's different to the film. So I'm like, ooh, interesting. But it's that whole idea of, like, you have someone who is not a good person, but because of the way they're built as a character and how they are shaped and everything, they're not more likable, but you can empathise with them and you can get on board with them doing stuff and you want to see them do whatever it is they're, you know, they're going to do.
Tom, you got anything to add?
again, I would just reiterate that this, to me, really is a highlight film of Hitchcock's work. It's, again, you know, if you if a person only had time to watch five Hitchcock films, you know, this has got to be one of them.
Yes.
And it's an, a beautiful example of Hitchcock has a habit of buying or taking stage plays and turning them into films. And this is one that works amazingly well as a film. And it's a real educational piece for people that are that aren't necessarily exposed to old style filmmaking, that this is a fine example of how good a film can be when it's only really set in one or two rooms and it's all characters, it's all personalities, and the weight of the story really rests on the shoulders of the actors, and they deliver amazingly well, right?
Yeah.
Chris, you got any final thoughts?
I was just thinking, I mean, I adore this film. Like Tom said, it's easily in the top five must-see Hitchcock, and I would absolutely agree. It, one of the things, there's a slight recommendation, and it just reminded me, because this film is so similar, there is a 70s movie called Wait Until Dark. If you like Dial M for Murder, watch Wait Until Dark, or vice versa, because it's a very similar premise, but it's brilliant. I can't recommend it enough. Audrey Hepburn basically plays a blind woman who ends up in possession of something that she shouldn't be, and then people start trying to get the thing that she is in possession of, and it all takes place in the downstairs flat of this building in New York, and it's absolutely top-notch, fantastic. It's very Hitchcock. Which made me think then when I was thinking about just going through the film. Apart from that, I really enjoy the way this film is shot. I love the way that it's really anchored in these incredible performances, and it's a real shame we didn't get more with kind of everyone, really, because I know John Williams, obviously, like you said, he reappears in Hitchcock Presents, and in Grace Kelly we have Rear Window and To Catch a Thief, but it would have been great to have more Ray Milland, because I think he works so well with Hitchcock. I think it's someone who they either bring out the best in each other.
Yeah, I don't have much for final thoughts other than it's starting to get hard to rank my Hitchcock films, right? Because we've got a lot of good stuff that's come up over the last little bit. I mean, like, my top 12 that we've covered so far are five-star films, right? So, like, you're really splitting hairs when you're trying to rank these films, right? You're like, I got to my list, and when I needed to put it where it was, it's like, okay, which one of these films do I like it more than? If I had to pick a movie right now, would I pick this one or that one? Okay, then it goes here. Now with the next film, which one? Would it be this one or that one? Okay, then I'll put it here. And, you know, it's getting really hard to rank them. But, like, what a career with so many great films, you know, to have these 12 films so far ranked as five-star films for me. I love this film. I'm going to give this 5 out of 5 keys. And this is definitely in my top five. Right now, my top five, I've got The Birds, Psycho, Rope, Dial M for Murder, and Rebecca as my top five. And I mean, like, that's pretty solid for a top five.
That's really good.
You know,
I'll give this, Tom, I'll give, I'll rate it 5 out of 5 mustache combs.
Oh, last scene, he's combing his mustache.
That is such a in your face kind of, okay, I've done this, now what shall I do?
And it happens such with that little move, kind of flute on the soundtrack as well. It's that kind of, it's just such a fun way to end.
Yeah, no, I love that. Funny.
Chris, what would you give us? 2? Sounds like a 2. Probably a 2.
I'm not allowed to swear on this podcast. How dare you? Because you just cursed at me. This is a 5 out of 5 stiff drinks to be poured, because you haven't got away with murder. You're probably going to get, you know, arrested and tried and hanged for it. But you still Ray Milland, so it's still a win.
Yeah. Excellent. Right on. Well, we kind of teased it a little bit in this episode, so I think it's time that we let the listeners know what we're going to be doing this summer. What do you think, guys?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure. Okay, so our next couple of windows, and we will at some point this summer, I'm sure we're going to do our audio commentary. Yes. We've been doing an annual audio commentary, and that's a lot of fun, and the listeners really seem to like that. We get a lot of good downloads from our audio commentaries. But coming up next, the next three movies are Rear Window, To Catch a Thief, and The Trouble with Harry. And you may have heard us say that, well, we've watched these Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes. After we get to The Trouble with Harry, we're actually going to start our concurrent coverage of the Alfred Hitchcock Presents and Alfred Hitchcock Hour episodes that Hitchcock directed. So what we're going to be doing is, after The Trouble with Harry, we're going to go to weekly releases. Now, they're not long episodes. They're like maybe, you know, 15 minutes-ish, 20 minutes long. And we're going to be talking about the episodes that Hitchcock directed. So after Trouble with Harry, we're going to do... the next week will be Revenge, and then Breakdown, and then The Case of Mr. Pelham, and then Back for Christmas. And then we're going to do The Man Who Knew Too Much remake. Now, after that, we'll cover Wet Saturday, which we mentioned today. But that's the only episode that he directed between The Man Who Knew Too Much and The Wrong Man. So then there'll be like a couple of weeks until we get to The Wrong Man. So we're gonna cover and continue to cover the episodes in concurrence with the films. But we don't want to do once a month for these because they are just kind of short, bite-sized podcasts. So we just kind of want to get them all out there for you. That's going to be continuing all the way until we get to The Birds. So the last one that we're going to cover is before The Birds is called I Saw the Whole Thing from the Alfred Hitchcock Hour. And then that's the last television episode that he directed. And then we'll be covering The Birds, and then we'll just finish out with his films. So that's what's coming along the pipeline for our Alfred Hitchcock podcast. Good evening. And we're looking forward to it. We've recorded about six or seven of the Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes so far. And I think it's going to be a nice little treat to add on and give you some content over the next, well, probably close to a year. So, awesome. Excellent. Right on. Tom, where can people find you when you're not combing your mustache?
I spent a lot of time recently over on the Facebook. You've heard of Facebook, have you? It's a new thing.
Yes,
and
I have.
We do a lot of stuff on there with our Hitchcock Good Evening page, and we encourage the listeners to participate and share and like and comment and come on over and say hi anytime you get a chance.
Excellent. Right on. Chris, where can people find you when you're not trying to sell your boyfriend's car for 300 extra pounds profit?
Can you imagine if I had a boyfriend and he was like, what? And I'm like, nothing, don't worry about it. You can find me on Twitter at @Hire_boy. Come say hi. Yeah, no doubt we'll be chatting and having fun. So yeah, feel free to stop by and say hi.
Excellent. And when I'm not winding my watch too tight, you can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. And I got a couple other podcasts. I'm just finished up my run of Christopher Nolan films on House Lights over on the Nerd Party Network. And due to my work schedule, I'm not going to be able to continue with that podcast. So that'll be the last that I can do over there. And then right now we're doing every other week a release still with Infinite Diversity, which is the Star Trek podcast I do, and Franchise Fatigue, which is the movies, remakes, and sequel film podcast that I do. And those are both available on my own created podcast network called the United Federation of Podcasts. Thank you so much to Jason Cullimore for creating our wonderful theme music. Thanks to the guys over at the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting our show. You can find us in their feed as well as in our own independent feed. Please be sure to check out our friends Annie and Catherine, where they have a show called Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast, and they cover all of the episodes of that show. So between their show and our show combined, you get a near comprehensive look at the Grandmaster's work. And yeah, I think that's all our thanks. So thank you to the listeners. Give us a rating and a review. We haven't had one in a while. Give us one. Come on. We would appreciate it.
Do it.
Do it. Do it. Do it, or I'll send Swan after you. No? Okay. We won't do that. Tom said no. Okay. Well, until next time when we cover Rear Window, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.